That you get organized and we can get started. Okay, good morning, everyone. Let's get started in this work session, which frankly for me is a much awaited day. Because just about a year ago this week, I went on a ride along with Aaron Schmautz, one of our officers in East Precinct, and it was an eventful night in a couple of ways. But one way in which it was eventful was that he knew all the vacant, abandoned houses in his patrol area, and he'd been to them again and again and again. Several of them were occupied by squatters. Several of them had been boarded up for years. Meanwhile, I know a lot of young people who are trying to buy their first home and are willing to buy anything in order to get that opportunity that I had when I bought a fixer-upper as my first house in Portland. And we're in a housing crisis in which we have unhoused people and people desperate to stay in the housing market. So what a disconnect that in a city with a red-hot housing market with a lot of people that need housing, where you can sell property for a very good return if you happen to own property, we have houses that are zombie houses and that are an enormous blight on their neighborhoods. So we have some city staff here who've been working hard on this issue, collaborating together between the auditor's office and Bureau of Development Services and my office and others, Police Bureau in particular, thank you, for cooperating and coming up with some very good ideas and proposals for how we can collectively get our act together and make a difference on this issue. So the good news is, I think, although this situation is currently unacceptable, we have the tools in our hands as city leaders to actually make a real difference on this issue. So I'm looking forward to doing just that, and I want to start this work session by calling up the two people in my office who've been working on this issue for quite a while now, Zach Klonoski and Chad Stover. Come on up. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Are we on? Okay. Good morning. Thank you, Mayor Hales and City Commissioners. My name is Chad Stover. My title is Livability Project Manager on the Mayor's staff. I'm here with my colleague, Zach Klonoski, who's Policy Advisor. And first, I'd like to hand out a run of show. I'm not sure if anyone, if we got this. Carly, can I? Okay. A few that way. So Mayor Hales did a good job opening up the conversation. I'll continue just opening it up a little bit. And first, I would like to paint a picture for you. In this conversation, we are really focused in on the vacant and distressed property, sometimes colloquially known as a zombie home. Now, in 3 years of working on livability issues under Mayor Hales' office, this is a phone call that has come into me, I know. It's not unusual at all for it to come in a couple times a month, three times a month, from somebody in East Portland or sometimes in North Portland where they're complaining about a nearby house where there's all kinds of chronic nuisance activities happening, drug trafficking, prostitution, other livability issues that have become a nuisance to the neighborhood, and they want to know what they can do about it. And at first, it might seem like a common sense thing to just call the police and to work with crime prevention. And you dig a little deeper into it, and you find out that actually it's not that simple at all, because what you learn is that the owner of the house could be deceased, and there's no heir to the property. This could be somebody who was living there and didn't really have much of a relationship with their neighbors, fell under hard times, fell behind on their mortgage payments, and received a notice of default from the bank. And that person didn't know his or her housing rights. And upon receiving that notice of default, he or she may have assumed this means that I have to get out right now, and out of panic and not knowing their housing rights, they end up leaving. And that person takes off and they leave town, and now nobody knows where they are, and because they didn't have much of a relationship with anybody in their neighborhood anyways, it's really hard for anybody to get in touch with that person. And that becomes a challenge for police officers and for our crime prevention staff who are working with the neighborhoods, because in the meantime, you might have squatters that move into the house, and in order to actively deal with that, we need to be in touch with the owners of these properties to issue trespassing, which creates a real challenge. So today, specificity as we begin this conversation, because when we talk about the topic of chronic nuisance homes, oftentimes you could have the owner that's living in the house. And we're not focused on that particular house today. We're really focused on the ones in which the property owner is not in the house. I've dealt with both in my time as working on livability in the mayor's office, but we want to disaggregate down to this vacant and distressed property, the quote-unquote zombie home, which there is no property owner around.
Chad, on the so-called zombie homes, is it likely that there's also some kind of collection action going on where the Water Bureau is trying to get paid its arrears, that there are building code violations and other things that have been placed on the title and other things? So is it possible that there are multiple city bureaus trying to track down the owner at any one time?
Absolutely. You hit it right on the head, Commissioner Fish, and you'll hear from some of those city staff today. So we have a lineup of speakers, and we've been strategic in the way that we have our lineup. You'll notice on your run of show, we'll first hear from one of our neighborhood response team officers out in North Precinct. Sergeant Randy Teig is here, and he has spent inordinate amounts of time working on these types of homes. We put him first because it's often the case that a call will come into the police because of some of the livability issues that are here. They'll be the first responder. They'll go out and see the house. We'll also hear from our crime prevention staff because at that point in time, police will often collaborate with crime prevention, and they'll start to go out and do outreach to the surrounding neighbors about different techniques and methods that they can use to deal with the chronic nuisance issues. We also have Ms. Sally Bowman is here, and she is a neighbor who lives near one of these homes, and so you will hear firsthand testimony from one of the neighbors who knows what it's like to be next to one of these homes. And we will also hear from the auditor's office, my colleague Zach, that will talk about the foreclosure program that they have. The foreclosure manager is housed under the auditor's office, and they will be here to talk us through that process. And my colleague Zach is going to talk about a new concept that we're looking at here called the receivership model, something the city has explored in the past and can do so. And we have looked at best practices in other cities to find out what's working elsewhere. And we have some ideas on how that might be able to be implemented here in Portland. And so that's our run of show. And your question is spot on, Commissioner Fish. It's always not just one agency within the city, but multiple offices that are responding in some shape to these kinds of homes. To help with the dialogue as we move forward, we're actually going to exemplify two specific houses that we thought are classic cases that represent this kind of vacant and distressed property. One of them, the address is 14630 Southeast Carruthers. Just a little bit of background, and you'll hear more about this from our experts in their testimony. This is a violation case that was opened up in 2010, and it has now collected $80,000 in liens on this house. So that's one house you'll hear about. Another house that you're going to hear about is 7926 Southeast 75th Place. This one was opened up in April of 2013, and it has now collected $85,000 in city liens. They're both vacant. These both fall under our definition of a vacant and distressed property. That's correct. One thing that I want to emphasize as we kick off this conversation is that Zach and I have been on something of a journey in our research and our learning curve, working with our colleagues in the Bureau of Development Services and the Police Bureau. And what we have learned is that as much as we wanted this to be a relatively simple fix, it is not a simple fix. We have come to realize that there is no silver bullet to curing this kind of problem. But we think that with the recommendations that we want to put forth today, that if we work collaboratively as a city and we muster some existing tools and think about bolstering some possible new tools working in harmony, we think that with everything moving on full cylinders, we can start pushing the needle on this a little bit. So I just want to create that context.
Chad, are there any sister cities that are doing good work in this area that you've looked at?
Absolutely, and you'll hear from Zach in a few minutes about the receivership model. I know he's done some research in Baltimore, St. Louis, and through working with our foreclosure office and the auditor's office, they've come up with a number of ideas that we've looked at in other cities as well. So probably one of the biggest assets that we've had in conducting our research on this is looking elsewhere, because to help also create the context for this conversation, it's important to know that this is not a Portland-specific challenge. This is something that is affecting American cities all across the country. And so that takes us into the bigger conversation. And what we hope today is that if we can bring all of our tools together in the city of Portland and become a unified voice, that's going to put us in a better standing to have the bigger conversation with the banks, because the banks are a huge part of this. And creating that awareness at their level so that they know what kinds of things are happening locally is also important. Just a quick anecdote from myself working on livability issues and some of my colleagues that you'll hear from today who have actually tried to track down these owners. Not uncommon at all that we end up three or four phone calls later talking to somebody who is representing a bank in a far-off place like Omaha, Nebraska or St. Paul, Minnesota, and they've never been to Portland before. They don't know what 14630 Southeast Carruthers even is, or yet alone what Southeast Portland is. And it's a number on an Excel sheet to that person because they're dealing with these in such large masses. And so it's important for us to understand that national context, to understand what we really need to do locally to start pushing the needle on this in the right direction.
Okay. Yep, Sergeant Tuck.
Actually, got Zach. Sorry.
Mayor, members of the City Council, for the record, my name is Zach Klonowski. I work as policy advisor to Mayor Hales. I want to touch very briefly about what I see as five big opportunities we seize by tackling this issue, and some of them have already been touched on, but the lack of affordable single-family houses here in Portland. To me, learning about this issue as we, Chad and I, kind of went through our journey, it's unconscionable that we have vacant, derelict properties rotting away when we're dealing with a housing affordability crisis and a homelessness crisis. The lack of housing inventory, especially modest single-family houses, is an issue that we're all struggling with, and dealing with these vacant distressed properties can help alleviate at least some of that housing shortage. And as the mayor alluded to, we have a red-hot housing market right now, so there's no doubt that there's a market for these houses if the city uses its resources to clear clouded title, which you'll learn today we have the ability to do. And then this is an equity issue, because far more of these vacant distressed properties are located in low-income neighborhoods, and no neighborhood should be subjected to the nuisances that arise when a home is left vacant and abandoned. The term we hear over and over describe these houses from neighbors is that it's a nightmare. And then that goes right into livable neighborhoods, and removing barriers to get responsible property owners into these homes will help create more livable neighborhoods in all of the city. And then lastly, freeing up scarce police bureau resources is a huge potential gain from this. As you are all aware, we're dealing with an epidemic of gang violence, and having police officers respond to these houses over and over again rather than dealing with some of the tough challenges that we're dealing with as a city is something that we hope to correct. So Chad already walked you through the presentation, so we'll go ahead and turn it over to Randy Tagg.
Hey, Warmest Mayor and City Council folks, I'm Dave Hendry. I'm the East Precinct Commander, and I just want to give you kind of a brief overview, just like Chad and Zach did, about kind of the distressed properties deals that we have at East. Randy will talk specifically on a couple cases, but to give you a scope of where we're at, we have approximately 375 of these properties just in East Precinct that they are managing of one level or not. We have calls on our distressed properties, burglaries and trespassing to those properties every day. Every day our officers are responding to that. There's a huge resource cost for that for us, for law enforcement. As you know, we're short on staffing, and yet these are priority calls that we do need to go to. These homes left vacant, dilapidated, become crime hubs in these neighborhoods. And ultimately our goal is for protecting that neighborhood, oftentimes when we can't have a property owner present. That proves to be very difficult. We don't have a lot of tools for that. What we do have is our neighborhood response team, which is a specific group of officers that we can detail out to work on community and livability problems just in the precinct. Sergeant Tagg and his group focus primarily on the distressed properties with about probably 50% of your workload.
Oh, yeah.
So with that being the case, it is a huge priority from us from a safety piece, from a community livability piece, and also effective resource management tool for us. Randy?
In the way of overview, we have, as the commander said, 375 houses that we're managing, and we have secured over 400, so just in each precinct. And in the way of hours, I should have brought my reading glasses. I appreciate that.
What's your prescription? You have four options.
It works perfectly. We're looking at administrative warrants. We've done 169 administrative warrants. That's working with BDS and other city bureaus, and that's 3,000 PPB hours in that. The 375 houses that we manage, and this is every day, we have 4,503 hours at the time I did this, human resource hours into those. Since 2014. And as we said before, at this time we had 395 documented houses. And the neighborhood response team, what we've done is, as the commander said, this is a big part of what we do now. It's the number one complaint we get. And we have special training that our officers have gone through. They've gone with BDS and learned what to look for, how to photograph these things. And we also went to the federal government, gave us some training on how to identify house theft. And it's hard to believe that's happening, but we have problems with people actually stealing these houses and defrauding people that they rent to and that type of thing. And to give you an idea, since we started doing this, this multidisciplinary group, which includes aging services, we use Fire Bureau, we use BDS, BES, and crime prevention. All of us work together as a group because sometimes there's unique scenarios here. As was pointed out, sometimes it's a house that's a very aged person lives there and is being taken advantage of, and it goes into to the point where it needs to be condemned. It can actually get that bad. So we bring in these social services to deal with these types of things. But to give an idea of the kind of time that goes into them, the 14630 Southeast Carruthers, this dating back to 2012, started out when it first went vacant, we had three calls for service, and then it went up to five. And then once someone discovered it was vacant, we had 27 calls for service there, and then 10, and then we went in, boarded it up, zero calls for service. And that's, and the NERT hours involved in that was just about 70 hours. Just for that one location. And then 7926 75th Place was one that got in the news quite a bit. It was that bad. And the neighbors and the schools were very upset about it. And that one there, we had about 95 calls for service before we boarded it up and vacated it. And we had about 96 hours of NERT hours, just NERT officers, so into that place. And to give you an idea of the impact that we've had, this multidisciplinary group. We did a little study at 500 feet from the crime hub and what kind of impact it has on the neighborhood. So just in short, part one and two crimes, we had a 28% reduction in crime by addressing the house, getting it boarded up, and denying access. And that's part one and two combined. But burglaries, 42% reduction in burglaries and 50% reduction in vice. So it's the other side of that is we have a lot of effective prevention happening by addressing it, but that informs you how much crime it's generating, you know, just by how much we affected the crime load by dealing with it.
So is Hugo, somebody going to tell us why it took 95 visits before you were able to board it up?
Yes. it's first of all, because it's private property, it's a complicated issue for us to get to the point where we can go in it and take some action. So what we did is we consulted DOJ, did some work on this back in 2012. We consulted some of the work they did. This is a huge problem in the state of Maryland. They have a big problem with this. And so there's a lot of research that was done on that. So what we did is we built a plan that enabled us, when the call comes in, we actually have a building block approach to it from that point. The neighbors complain about it. We don't go looking for them, but when the neighbors complain about it, then there's evidence of vacancy, which is a state law. And state law says, if there's certain things present, broken windows, broken doors, trash and litter, that gives us the ability to understand that this is a vacated property. And once it's a vacated property, we know, based on what the DOJ has told us, that they are a health and crime hazard. And
And this has been documented. There's a lot of documentation to support that. So we utilize that best practice to support our enforcement action. And then we move forward, we get in, we board it up, we bring the Bureau of Development Services in, and that's when the fine process that we talked about on these two houses begins. And sometimes we have to vacate people out of the houses. Sometimes they're already vacant.
Great. Thank you both.
Yep.
And obviously some of these folks will still be around and we get to discussion here, but we want to make sure we hear from each of the members of this team. So now Stephanie Reynolds from Crime Prevention, talk about her perspective on this.
Good morning. Hello, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Stephanie Reynolds. I'm the manager of the Crime Prevention Program with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. And as I think you know, crime prevention staff, we work very closely with neighbors to help them resolve their chronic crime issues. And zombie houses are one of the most frustrating things that we ever work with. We get calls from neighbors, and we talk to them about exactly what they've tried so far to resolve the issue, and then we try to identify what gaps there might be in what's happened so that we can try to make a whole package of an approach for them to give them the best chance of getting the problem resolved. But I've got to say that even when all the bureaus are participating, even when the neighbors are organized with each other, even when everybody is doing everything they possibly can, it's still incredibly difficult to resolve these issues. And our staff, I polled them just a couple of weeks ago and said, so from your most recent work, how much time are you spending on this? And particularly for our staff in East Portland, but also for our staff in North, we're collectively spending about a half-time position on just vacant houses alone. And we deal with dozens and dozens and dozens of crime issues. This is a particularly time-consuming one, and it's a particularly frustrating one because of the stress of the community members that we're interacting with. People call us crying, sobbing. I'm not exaggerating. It is just unbelievably stressful and disgusting to have one of these houses next to you. I think one of the most, one of the happiest days that we ever have with these houses is the days when one of these houses is boarded up either by the police or by BDS, and we're able to go out with them. And what we do is we go around to the neighbors and we post these notices both on the house that's being boarded up, and then we also pass them out to the neighbors immediately surrounding the house. And we explain to the neighbors what's going on, why the house is being boarded. Usually they know exactly why the house is being boarded. And we give them some instructions on what to do if they see anybody trying to break back into the house, which unfortunately is not uncommon. Sometimes houses have to be boarded up repeatedly. But I can't tell you how joyful neighbors are, how they feel when they see the house being boarded up, because even though a boarded up house is not very attractive, it is far superior to what they've experienced up to that point. In a moment, we're going to have Hazelwood resident Sally Bowman come up and talk to you. She's had the misfortune of having to live next door to two of these houses, which, you know, one is more than anybody should have to bear, but two is just over the top. But I wanted to tell you briefly about the experience of a couple of other neighbors who weren't able to be here today. One of them is Rodolfo Ortega, who asked me to give you this picture of the backyard of his neighbor's house. What happened in this case is that Rodolfo's neighbor passed away, and this is in Palhurst, Gilbert, by the way. His neighbor passed away, and the house was taken over by squatters. And so for 2 years, Rodolfo, his girlfriend Amanda, and their neighbors had to deal with drug deals, discarded syringes, prostitution, human waste. Squatters were literally cutting pieces off the house in the garage to burn in the fireplace because there was no heat in the house and the squatters needed heat. So it was a very stressful situation, and Rodolfo told us that he felt really scared and helpless, and that two of his neighbors actually moved away during this time because it was taking such a long time to resolve, they just couldn't take it anymore, so they moved away, which I think is really tragic. I also want to tell you the story of Mill Park resident Sharon Bohan. So her neighbors went into default and moved out of their house probably prematurely. They could have stayed longer. So there was this gap time during which the house went into limbo before the bank took it over. And she and her neighbors just endured, again, enormous piles of trash, a rat infestation. A lot of them had rats come into their house because of the piles of trash at the squatter house. and really blatant heavy drug use by the squatters. She said that one morning she looked out and there was a very frail, drug-addicted woman passed out in 40-degree weather on the squatter house porch, and she thought the person was dead. It was, you know, frightening and stressful. Before the squatters moved out, they realized that she was the one who had been complaining to BDS, and one of the squatters told her that he was going to take her out before he was kicked out of the house. And so even after the squatters moved out, she spent 6 months sleeping with a knife next to her bed because that's how frightened she was of what might happen. I think that this is a problem that's uniquely stressful for neighbors, and they're often really astonished that it takes as long as it does take to resolve the issue. And so I'm really happy to be here today. Happy is the wrong word, but I'm pleased to be here today to talk about their experience and to hear about some interesting and innovative ways that we might be able to resolve these problems more quickly for people because, so they don't have to endure this. So thanks for listening.
Good morning. I'm Sally Bowman, as you can see from the sheet. I wrote out a little speech for you because I was nervous. Well, I moved into East Portland, East Precinct. I live between 135th like Division and Stark, right by Lincoln Park Elementary School. And we moved there because my mom was working out in Sandy and my husband works downtown, so we wanted something kind of central between the two. And we also wanted somewhere for kids, you know, because there's a park in the school. And I have three, well, at the time I had three kids. So when we moved in, the neighborhood was great. People next door were great. People on the other side were kind of quiet. They worked nights, so I didn't know them very well. And then in 2010, so we moved in 2009, 2010, they were foreclosed and they moved out. And nothing really happened at first. You know, you got some weeds growing really tall. So tried to get a hold of them. They were hard to reach. Finally got them on Facebook and said, hey, you know, your weeds are really tall. Can you do something about it? And they're like, we don't live there anymore. And we're not going to even go there. They took our house. It's not our house, not our problem. So, well, who do you contact? So I called the police. Well, I didn't call the police. I talked to my neighbor and she called somebody and got the weeds taken care of. And that was awesome because then no more weeds, right? And you're thinking, okay, these people are gone. The house is in foreclosure. It's going to get taken care of, right? I mean, it's 2010. So, weeds are taken care of. So yeah, I'm going to look at my list here of things that happened. Oh, and then somebody decided they wanted to move into the house. A squatter, that is. Somebody who shouldn't be moving into the house. And we didn't really notice them at first because they were coming at night. But then we started seeing trash around the house and we started seeing, like, I don't know, like, they were throwing bottles out in the yard and they were, like, leaving litter around and the house was starting to kind of smell funny. And this is right next door to me. Like, so I'm here, they're here. And so we're like, well, there's somebody in there that shouldn't be there. We're going to have to call the police, right? So called the police. Police came out, and they weren't home when the police got there. So police were like, well, we can't make them leave. They're not there. So they're coming back at night repeatedly. So they said they would board it up. That was great. We're really happy. Police came in, boarded it up, and the management, we tried to get a hold of the management company, put a big sticker on the window. And management company was impossible to get a hold of. So they boarded the house up, not all of the windows, just the ones that were broken into. And then along comes the next squatter. And they were like, oh, look, this house is vacant. We can see that because there's a big sticker on the window that says that the house is empty. So they moved in, and we called the police. Please come back. Because they had kicked down the boarded up door to get in. And in the meantime, this house is starting to smell worse and worse, you know. So the police came out again, and the new management, because the management changed during this time. Like, they had a no trespass agreement with the first management company, and with the previous owner didn't want anything to do with it. They wouldn't sign a no trespass agreement. But the management company was like, yes, you can go in. So that was good. And so then again, you know, squad room is in, call the police, police get them out. We went through that 3 or 4 times. And then finally, there was kind of a scary guy that moved in with a big knife, and he's like whacking, you know, the stuff around the house with his machete or whatever to try to, you know, cut back the bushes so he can get in the backyard to go in the house. So I'm like, oh, call the police again. I think I called the police. At this point, I've talked to every single one of the people in the response center, like, oh, hi, it's me again. Can you send someone out as soon as possible to move these people along? So that was, let's see, 2012. We had people that were walking through our yard because there was a space in the fence that they could just step over. And it was easier to walk through our yard than the vacant house yard. So I was not happy about that. I went out and was yelling at them. My husband was like, I'm not in the house. Don't go out there and fight with these people that you don't know. You're going to get in trouble. Oh, my car was broken into in 2012. And they stole a bunch of little random things. But, you know, it's under $200. I can't claim it on my homeowner's insurance. Called the police, and they said, well, we're not going to come out to file a report because it's only, like, you know, it's a small amount of money. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a small amount of money. I don't have, like, $200 to go out there and buy it all again. So you just live without it. And then, we had another squatter that actually moved, like, their entire, like, everything in the kitchen sink into the house, like, everything. They had, like, their stuff for the bathroom. They had their TV. They were going to set up housekeeping here. They had piles and piles of stuff. We saw it because they moved it back out when the police came and told them to leave. And the neighbors taking pictures, like, look at all this crazy piles of stuff. They're moving in. So they left. Oh, and when they boarded up the house again, these people came out and they took a jigsaw. I kid you not. These people cut a hole in the door because it was boarded shut. They took, and they, I was so surprised to come home with, like, this big hole in the door. Because then what do? How do you board that up? I guess put another bigger board, but it starts to get expensive after a while. Oh, and then it was graffitied. The side of the house is graffitied, and it wasn't just words. It was like a big picture of something you don't normally see on the side of a house, you don't want to see on the side of a house. And I live next door to this house. Well, next door to that house is another house, a red house. And that red house became vacant as well. And because those people went in, they didn't go into foreclosure, she says. I talked to her as well, and she said that she's working with the bank. So it's been 2 years since she moved out. And then directly across the street from that is the elementary school. So we've got this, you know, gross graffiti on the side of the house facing the elementary school. Anytime the kids drive down the street, you know, everybody parks on our street to take their kids to school, so they're going to see that. You have so many bureaus you have to contact if you want something done, and you try to contact just one, and they're like, no, you need to call here, and so you call there, and sometimes you get the person, sometimes you don't. It gets really frustrating after, well, I guess it's been 5 years now that I've been dealing with these crazy people in and out. Let's see. So that was the first house. The first house, all sorts of lovely things happened there. Then 2015, the red house was vacant. These people moved out. So it's looking okay at first, you know. They're coming back, trimming the bushes and stuff for the first year or so. Then after about the first year, they live in Gresham now. They're like, oh, we're tired of dealing with this house now. So then the trash starts to accumulate at the house, and the weeds start to get really long, and people move in. And these people that moved in there were, they were also breaking into cars again, so I got my car broken into again. And the neighbor across the street had their car stolen, and the people on the block behind us got their car stolen. And we didn't think it was entirely related, but we knew that these people had had issues with other people, because we had finally kind of collaborated with each other. I mean, I had 4 neighbors that kind of triangulated the house, and we would, like, talk to each other about the house. Oh, hey, there's somebody, you know, somebody parked in the driveway. And then so I'd look in the backyard because I had access to the backyard, you know, and they'd look in the front yard, and we kind of make sure that there wasn't anybody, you know, in and out. And there were people in and out. And so we called the police about that. And we also contacted the neighbor that owned the house because we actually knew her phone number, talked to her. And she said to us, oh, they're just normal homeless people living in the house and it's raining. Just let them stay while it rains and they'll leave on their own. And they were there in and out of that house. We told them to leave, you know, because we were finding needles in the street. We got trash in the yard and it's starting to smell again. I mean, this house still smells if you come over and walk by it because it's starting to warm up now. It's like, hold your nose and walk past the house towards the park. But anyhow, I'm trying to think if there was anything else that was fun that happened at that house. Not fun, but yes, they are. One of them actually sold. We've got somebody in there tearing out all the innards, and I'm worried about them. I think they should be wearing protective gear because, I mean, they're exposed to not only, like, the needles, because I told you there's lots of needles inside that house. When there was one of the police that came out had us come over with him because we told him that we thought there might be someone inside and we were willing to help with the boarding up. I mean, we had that house next door to us boarded up repeatedly, so we got to know the police pretty well. And also, you know, if the police don't show up right away and the people have left and the house is, like, kind of open, it's like, okay, we want to close that up. So we'd go over there and look, and it's just so gross in there. I mean, I told you it smells, but they use the toilet, and there's no running water in these houses, and it is overflowing. It's not just, like, you know, once or twice. It's, like, everywhere. There's poop everywhere. And there was also, they used adult diapers in the closet in the bedroom because now, you know, the bathroom is unusable. So they're in the bedroom doing this yucky stuff. So I live right next door to this, and I have 4 kids now. And I don't want to let my little kids out in the yard because, you know, what are they being exposed to? It's gross. Anyhow, so... yeah, these guys that are in there now, they're just in there now, like this last month. They bought the house, the first house that I talked about. Yeah, they bought the house from auction, or actually I think that somebody else bought it from auction and then sold it to them. But they're in there working on it. I'm like, I really hope you're wearing a mask and gloves at least, if not like full body armor, you know. But I don't... 2010 and... Well, it's actually 2016. So, yeah, 6 years of living next to this pile of yuckiness. Anyway. And the neighbors are all, you know, we formed a neighborhood watch in March, actually. So that's how I've talked to crime prevention multiple times. I was in touch with the first crime prevention coordinator, no longer works there. Next crime prevention coordinator, no longer works there. Now I'm in touch with Celeste Carey, who's the crime prevention coordinator for my neighborhood. She's pretty awesome. So hoping she'll stick around and hoping that this Red House on the End gets taken care of. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so now the response
that we have in BDS, Mike Liefeld's here, and Mitch McKee is also here as a recently retired guy. I would appreciate you making a victory lap here. And you've got some slides?
We
so,
will,
so
yes.
We might want...
Sure, yeah, we can... oh, yeah, yeah, right, yeah, yeah, please. Yes. So good morning, Mayor, members of council. My name is Mike Liefeld. I'm the BDS Enforcement Program Manager. And as we already know Mitch McKee, he's my lead senior housing inspector for the Extremely Distressed Property Enforcement Program, recently retired on April 1st. So this is his commitment. He loves the program, wants it to succeed. We formed the Extremely Distressed Property Enforcement Program in 2011. At the height of the economic recession and the peak of mortgage-related foreclosures. This was a new program, not new tools, but it was a new focus area for the Bureau. We moved from a model of compliance education to I would say extreme enforcement to deal with, tackle these serious problems at some chronic properties. We focused on unmaintained properties, often caused by abandonment, illegal squatting, and foreclosures. These properties have nuisance and housing conditions on the property that create risks of fire, public health hazards, encourage criminal activity such as trespass, vandalism, graffiti, drug use and sale, prostitution, and additional serious public safety threats. So what the Bureau leverages is the city's property maintenance code, where we address the exterior conditions of the property, the structure, and the interior conditions. We have a number, we're a complaint-based enforcement program, so we have no shortage of complaints every year. But when we talk about these extremely distressed properties, we came up some criteria to figure out what we were gonna assign our resources to. Those criteria include abandoned foreclosed properties with illegal occupancies. Abandoned foreclosed properties generate multiple complaints to BDS, ONI crime prevention, and Portland Police Service calls regarding illegal activity. Occupied properties without the minimum utilities, such as current water service, electrical service, a heat source, etc. Those are serious fire life safety dangers for occupants and surrounding property owners. And then we look at abandoned foreclosed properties with chronic, significant, and recurring nuisance and housing maintenance violations, which have resulted in unpaid enforcement lien balances. And we'll get into that more in the presentation. So again, program started in 2011. We currently have 55 EDPEP cases that are active right now throughout the city. We have another 49 cases that are pending, which we haven't had a chance to get to start working up the case. Since 2011, we have resolved 88 violation cases at the properties. I think in talking with Mitch, I think we've vacated over 50 properties in that span of time. We've completed 5 demolitions of structures, and we have 2 other demolitions that are pending. So again, this is a really, it diverges from our educational compliance-based model, where we are trying to exercise all the authority granted to us in Title III and Title 29 of the City Code. So again, with the EDPEP program, we're citing violations, we're pursuing extreme enforcement, we're going through the code hearing. It is a lengthy process. We have to obtain that legal authority to get the search warrants, get the vacate orders, go through the demolition process. Demolition is the last resort. The Bureau's interest is not in knocking down every structure. We really look to a demolition when the property has lost all of its utility. It's not salvageable, and that is really the only reasonable course of action. With the EDPEP program, we make a commitment to the neighbors. The EDPEP program, once you're in our queue, once we start a case, we're going to stay on that case until it's finished. And the finished for us means it's vacated or demolished. The correction of the cited violations may come several years later. But we make that commitment, so as PPB and crime prevention mentioned, we get calls from the neighbors. They know if it's broken into again, we're going to come out and board it quickly. We're going to vacate people off. So we work a lot with our other agencies to respond to neighborhood concerns even after the initial enforcement action. So with that, I want to turn it over to Mitch, who can take us through 2 properties that we want to highlight here, just for your information.
Thank you.
That one? Yep. Okay. Before I get started on these real quick, I did want to make a brief comment. The Sharon that Stephanie had talked about, who slept with the knife by her bed, when I had the hearing on this to vacate the property, the squatter showed up at the hearing, and Sharon was courageous enough to come to the hearing and testify on behalf. So that was just, I just wanted to mention that. 14630 Carruthers, the owner here received a notice of default in about July of 2009. She then moved out of the property, went out to live with her boyfriend in Gresham, and thought she was out of the picture there. We opened a case in December of 2010 for housing code violations, and cited it then. There were continuous calls for police bureau, continuous complaints to us for trash accumulations and debris.
The house was occupied by a niece, relative of the owner, and she rented out rooms at the property to make some extra money. Continued accumulations of trash. It was no power, no water in the house. We vacated the property in December of 2014 and boarded up the property. After that, there was a fire that occurred there in February of 2015. The property is still in the original owner's name, and the liens continue to accrue on this property for the enforcement case and for continued cleanups. 7926 Southeast 75th Place. The owner filed bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy papers showed that the property was discharged from the ownership in May of 2011. We actually opened a housing case in April of 2013 for housing code violations, and this house had enormous accumulations of trash and debris on the outside. It was occupied by a gentleman named Kenny who lived in the main house. There was an illegal addition on the back that was occupied. Two of the campers in the front were occupied, and a small building that was also illegal occupied in the backyard. And some of the people at this property were extremely bad folks, so the neighbors were real happy to see them gone. Continued calls to the police and complaints to us about trash and debris. The house was occupied again with no power, no water, no trash service. This one actually was featured in the media as well. And this is not uncommon. A bunch of these houses that I work on are featured in the media as being so bad as to have a huge impact on the neighborhood. We vacated and secured the property in January of 2014. Cleaned up the yard a second time, secured all the buildings. There were occasional break-ins after that, but mostly the most imperative problems went away at that point. The property is still in the original owner's name. It's been transferred to a different mortgage receiver, which is pretty common. What I found is that the banks will start their foreclosure process typically not until the property is vacated or empty, and work on the process for a year or two. It takes maybe 2 years to actually complete a foreclosure process, but I'm talking to some of the bank's attorneys that work on foreclosures. They're a little frustrated that once it nears the foreclosure end, the bank will block out maybe 100 or 200 properties, transfer them to another loan servicer, and that way they have to start the process all over again. It has a tendency to enhance the value of the property through inflation, so somehow these are to the bank's advantage. This continues to accrue liens on the property, and just one more little note is that the gentleman here, Kenny, actually moved into another house that was also an EdPEP property and continued to live there. Thank you.
So I just wanted to touch on a few more items. I mentioned that we currently have a large number of cases that are pending. Our program is complaint driven, and for the EdPEP properties, most of those complaints and referrals are coming from PPB and crime prevention. They have the best eyes on the street, and once we coordinate with them, we've made efficiencies so they can start collecting the evidence, make our enforcement process seamless so we can get to a code hearing sooner than later. So that's been a great coordination effort there. We currently have two full-time senior housing inspectors dedicated to the EdPEP program. We're just working through the case log. We work a case, get it to a point where we can step away from it for a little while, start the next case. In our budget request for fiscal year 16-17, we are asking for another full-time senior housing inspector position, our third EdPEP inspector, just to deal with the amount of referrals that are still coming into us.
In addition to more people to do the work, what else would be helpful to you in transitioning these properties from this unacceptable condition that they're in today? I mean, we've got to keep understanding that how unacceptable this is. I hope that's obvious to everyone. I know it's been obvious to you for a long time, but this is unacceptable in our city. That's our starting point. So given that it's unacceptable, given that you've been doing a good job with the program, given that you could use some more folks to do the work, what else would help?
So our response is not a long-term solution. It essentially is a Band-Aid for those surrounding neighbors where we secure the vacate order and in a small number, will demolish the house, but that is the exception. We certainly are interested in other tools available to relieve the property owner from that responsibility, because our cases are going to show that it could span a number of years, exceed 5 years, 7 years, where we do not have a responsible party who is willing to maintain the property up to the city's minimum standards.
So by relieve, you mean foreclose?
That is one tool, and I believe other jurisdictions use foreclosure. It is more than a collections effort. It is an enforcement effort at some level, and so I think we need to think about that, because we cannot relieve the owner's responsibility. We can take it up to the point where we vacate the property, but we're still maintaining the property then for a responsible party.
You're whether that's a property bank. Manager for
right,
a responsible owner.
Exactly. So, you know, if there's processes available that would get us to the point where we can maintain it, but then it's put into the market somehow or dedicated to get it back into a legal habitable use, that's the Bureau's interest.
Yeah, again, let me characterize that the way I've come to understand that, and that is the Police Bureau and the Bureau of Development Services are, in the current state of affairs, the property managers for extremely irresponsible property owners. We are spending large amounts of public funds to intervene again and again and to attempt to maintain a low-level condition for real estate owned by other people. That's what we do. I'm not criticizing what you do. I'm just saying we are the property managers for slumlords. Actually, worse than slumlords, because slumlords actually have paying tenants.
Just to clarify just a little bit, the people who own these properties retain title and ownership of property for all this time, all this 7 years that it takes. The banks are not acting as they should to foreclose on these properties. So it's hard to characterize the owner as the one that's being irresponsible.
The owner.
Yeah. So I guess, Mitch, maybe setting up future panels, but why are the banks not interested in putting a property that's not being used into the market? And then you mentioned, I was just curious about this point you mentioned about mortgage service providers right before the foreclosure deadline reaches, they transfer them to another company. Why do they do that again?
You know, I believe that the banks, I mean, this is just opinion. I'm not an expert on these legal matters, but I understand that the banks, the longer they let it sit, the more the value of the property increases. So it becomes pretty high. And then also the indebtedness of the owner, of the purchaser, also increases a huge amount. And I just want to make, to help with that point a little bit, I actually found a notice of trustee sale on the Carruthers property. And that notice was no payments from April of 2009. And the payments due were $138,000. And the total required for payoff is $351,000. So they have accrued all these additional charges in addition to their loan payoff amount. So it just becomes huge. Now, somehow that...
Does that include liens in that notice?
No, that's just the bank's money. That's just what they want.
I haven't entirely figured this out on a financial basis. I have a little understanding of real estate. You do as well, Dan. But I think what might be happening is that these properties aren't rising in value so fast that the bank makes more money if they wait, right? Because the house is losing value while the land in Portland's real estate market is gaining value. But while the house is being trashed, it's radically losing value.
Correct.
But their ability to write off a loss against taxes elsewhere in their corporate balance sheet might be enhanced by taking, let's say, a $300,000 loss on a house that honestly is only worth $100,000 because that's what the lot's worth. And that would be an extremely cynical thing for banks to be doing. So I don't know that they're doing that. But it might be that they're writing off losses in Omaha or New York based on the catastrophic decline of a house in Portland.
But Mayor, let me just jump in on something, because my impression during the recession is that banks were trying to shed their portfolios of these assets much more quickly. You had a lot of short sales, you had a lot, and so there was a different approach, which was get this stuff off the books. So I'm just trying to understand why has that changed? What's changed then? Is it some change in the law federally that created this perverse incentive? Is it different accounting rules? Is it market dynamics? Because again, I think during the recession we had lots of foreclosures and lots of short sales. And in my neighborhood, there were a lot of properties that were troubled properties that got fixed up and sold very quickly. And so what's...
Well, in a lot of cases, most of these properties have the foreclosures. There's tons of them everywhere. What we look at is the most distressed properties. And I also... So I think they act more quickly on a lot of those better value properties, the ones that will turn over and sell for a higher amount. But when it gets down to these bottom-end properties, so to speak... It's my understanding that they're actually federally insured, so it could be that when they get to a certain point, the banks can write it off and receive the money that their loan is guaranteed for. So again, I'm not the expert here, but that's just guessing again.
Mitch, we really appreciate your service. We're going to miss you.
Oh, well, thank you very
much.
But
hopefully, one of the things that you're leaving behind is an enhanced consciousness of the importance of the work that you've been doing and that others are carrying on, and that we can do a lot better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the police as well.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you both. Okay, let's now turn to a tool that we have not yet used enough, but that we might use more, and that is foreclosure. Sarah Landis. Good morning. Good morning.
I also have a PowerPoint presentation, but I have slides, so
okay.
Hopefully you can follow along. We go.
Thank you. Just pass them down.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Sarah Landis, Chief Deputy City Auditor, and with me is Marco Maciel. He's the Foreclosure Program Manager. And we are going to talk today about the city's existing foreclosure program. So Marco, if you could start the presentation. We've lost Carla, so our support staff, our technical support. Well, I'll go ahead and get started. We just need to get the PowerPoint up. So we'll start with the first slide. Foreclosure is a legal procedure in which a lien holder repossesses a property when an owner is in default on their liens. In the context we're talking about today, these are properties that have liens placed on them by the Bureau of Development Services, which is the lien holder. These can be liens for nuisance abatement, for which the city has incurred costs, or for code compliance penalties. And the process of foreclosure is managed by the auditor's office through the point of decision to foreclose by council, and the actual foreclosure sale is handled by the city treasurer. The next slide. With the introduction of the code enforcement program by BDS, the auditor's office saw a dramatic increase in the number of delinquent assessments. By 2003, there were about 3,700 special assessments in arrears in the amount of approximately $10 million. So this represents lost or delayed revenue back to the Bureau. To help address the increasing delinquency problem, the auditor's office proposed the reintroduction of foreclosure as a tool to recover delinquent assessments. one click. She's there.
Carla, you know you become indispensable.
The foreclosure program is a component of the Assessments, Finance, and Foreclosure Division in the Auditor's Office. It is funded through the Local Improvement District Fund, and it employs 1.5 FTE. The program serves bureaus across the city that assess properties to pay for improvements. These can be for local improvement district projects, for system development charges, sidewalk assessments, sewer projects, nuisance abatements, code enforcement fines, etc. So it's a pretty